I mean, there was a time some 30 years ago when the study of Shakespeare was in a real state of turmoil. An international establishment of Renaissance scholars tried to defend what they thought was a set of universal cultural values against a series of very heavily theoretically inflected assaults from a group that they labelled Young Turks. Now, their method of classification resembled for a while, I think, that of our present government's attitude to recent street riots, although I don't recall the epithet feral being used, and the only jail time we ever did was metaphorical. Scholars, though they undoubtedly were, the label that some of them chose, and I believe that that label originated in the United States, exposed the limits of their grasp of what was actually taking place, as well as showing a curious disregard for aspects of the European history of the last two centuries. I mean, suffice it to say that, as far as I'm aware, not one of these Young Turks was actually Turkish, nor could they be said to have coalesced into one single-minded barbarian horde. And it's one of life's academic ironies that what was thought to be beyond the pale 30 years ago is now regarded, so I'm told, as the new orthodoxy, and that those who were marginalised and in some cases demonised as Young Turks are now retiring from university chairs of English and in some cases pro-vice chancellorships, and whose current publications, of course, are now desperately sought by university administrations for forthcoming research exercises. Now, in invoking the topic of universal Shakespeare, I don't propose to go back and revisit that history or indeed to engage again in a conflict whose contours have very fulsomely been described by others. I mean, the ubiquity of Shakespeare is not in question. He was everywhere. He is everywhere. I mean, his image appears or used to appear on English banknotes. He's represented on credit cards. He's central to Anglo-American literature syllabuses in schools and universities. And he's a presence in those countries that used to form part of the British Commonwealth. And he was, so it was asserted, the prism through which human experience, all human experience, was viewed. Coming down the motorway yesterday, I also note that his name has been lent to a firm that makes beds. I was travelling too fast to note the email address, but I mean to follow it up to see if I can get a second best bed. Anyway, the following remark in a late essay by Goethe, I think, encapsulates the extent to which Shakespeare could actually transcend culture and history and yet still remain English. This is what Goethe says, and it's in translation because I don't speak German. It's said that he, Shakespeare, delineated the Romans with wonderful skill. He says, I cannot see it. They are Englishmen to the bone, but they are human, thoroughly human, and thus the Roman toga presumably fits them. When one takes this into consideration, one finds his anachronisms entirely admirable. Indeed, it's just his neglect of the outer form that makes his works so vital. He was a cultural icon then, quintessentially English, and at the same time, as we would now say, global. He was unique or singular, as the late Kenneth Muir used to say, claiming that the subtlety of his characterization survives the process of translation, the transplanting into alien cultures and the erosion of time. He's also claimed, of course, by other cultures, Welsh, Scottish. The late Norman McCaig used to insist to me that Shakespeare was Scottish, and when I asked what evidence he had, he told me that the sheer ability of the man justified the assertion. North American, of course, and if the playwright Bole Soyinka is to be credited, Arabic as well. Now, some of these claims, of course, we now realise, are related to the cultural capital that Shakespearean texts have accumulated and with which particular national cultures want to be identified. But they're also tied up, I think, in the complex political workings of colonial, post-colonial history, nicely parodied, I think, in Nicholas Meyer's film Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, in the figure of the diplomatic Klingon Chancellor Gorkon, who asserts condescendingly that you've never experienced Shakespeare until you've read him in the original Klingon. Now, in Meyer's film, of course, the battle for the future of mankind, where mankind is ultimately defined as including all anthropological life as human, depends upon effective possession and deployment of the most potent cultural weapon of all, rapid-firing Shakespearean quotations. And implied in this conflict is the assumed universality of Shakespeare, that in this case, of course, extends beyond a Homo sapiens-only club. Shakespeare's a cultural weapon that can be deployed with effectiveness by Captain Kirk's Federation and by the Klingon administration, deeply schooled in the discourse of post-colonialism, that the film mischievously identifies both with communism and with fascism. I mean, both sides have clearly read their Machiavelli, but as Marlowe's Machiavel would say, they guard him from their lips. It's universal, or in this case, galactic. Shakespeare, who's paraded as both an ideological weapon and ultimate prize. Indeed, the fascist General Chang accompanies his final assault on the starship Enterprise, the name of course is appropriate, from a position of concealment with a series of seven Shakespearean quotations, three of which are from Julius Caesar, one from The Merchant of Venice, one from The Tempest, and the final one from Hamlet. Mr. Spock's analytical observation that the Klingon warship emits gas follows immediately after Chang's sighting of Shylock's, "If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you prick us, shall we not bleed? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge?" Chang launches his final attack with Antony's lines from Julius Caesar, "Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war," followed by his citation of Caesar's own arrogant assertion before his assassination, "I am constant as the northern star." But his own battleship explodes as he utters Hamlet's line, "to be or not to be," the line that he'd earlier translated into Klingon. Now, we don't hear Captain Kirk's rejoinder, "not to be," as the Klingon battleship disintegrates into fragments. We're invited to read these quotations, not as quotations, but as utterances of a series of interlocking characters, ranging from the heroic Henry V through Shylock, Mark Antony, and Caesar, punctuated by quotation 5, "Prospero, our revels now are ended," and returning to Hamlet's ontological question, "to be or not to be," before exploding. The choices are subtle, and they expand significantly what would otherwise be a rather crude and an obvious caricature. Now, the allegorical meanings of Star Trek VI are wide-ranging and unusually dense, but the film takes its epigraph, "The Undiscovered Country," from Hamlet, and proceeds to translate a range of universally recognized Shakespearean quotations into a discourse appropriate to the political obsessions of a Cold War politics. The process is a sophisticated one, but not entirely new. Indeed, at the risk of being accused of claiming that the entirety of modern culture experience has already been anticipated by Shakespeare's texts, one of the main planks of the argument used to support his universality, it's not difficult to find instances of this kind of what I'm going to call, despite what Harris said this morning, cultural translation, in the plays themselves. For example, Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor is, on the surface of it, a parochially English play, and it's the nearest that Shakespeare ever got to writing a domestic comedy. It's an example that I've used at Warwick before, but I don't think that I've exhausted it, which is why I keep coming back to it. Now, the apocryphal story goes that Elizabeth I, after seeing Falstaff in the second tetralogy of history plays, requested a play that would represent him in love. Now, if indeed this request was made, then Shakespeare's response was coarse, I think, to say the least. Early on in the play, the fat knight laments that he's almost out at heels, but he has a plan. "My honest lads," he said, "I will tell you what I am about." Ancient Pistol interjects with a joke that exploits both a literal and an obscene meaning. "2 yards and more," he says. Now, Falstaff, of course, counters this particular obscenity with an impudent claim. No quips now, Pistol. Indeed, I'm in the waist 2 yards about, but I am about no waist. I am about thrift. Briefly, I do mean to make love to Ford's wife. I spy entertainment in her. She discourses, she carves, she gives the leer of invitation. I can construe the action of her familiar style and the hardest voice of her behaviour. To be Englished rightly is, I am Sir John Falstaff's. Now, the resilient Pistol, of course, not to be outdone, responds with a devastating punchline. He hath studied her well and translated her will out of honesty and into English. Now, poor Falstaff, of course, is the victim of his own outrageous fantasy. But what's of interest here is the way in which he frames his delusion and, of course, Pistol's response to it. He claims to be able to read and interpret Ford's wife's discourse and her body language, and he concludes that to be Englished rightly, to locate the essence of her expression, of her meaning, is, I am Sir John Falstaff's. Now, Pistol's reading of the situation, of course, acknowledges succinctly the complex cultural operation that's just taken place. The essence of Mistress Ford's demeanour, the abstract universal quality that she represents, signals honesty. But Pistol's ironic claim that Falstaff has studied her well is augmented with a statement that shows Pistol understands intralingual translation very well indeed. He hath studied her well and translated her will out of honesty and into English. The inaccurate homonyms well and will, taken together, expose the inadequacy of Falstaff's translation. Indeed, Shakespeare is later to return to this device and with similar effect in Macbeth, with the eponymous hero's musing, if the assassination could trammel up the consequence and catch with his surcease success. Now, translation in Shakespearean texts is a slippery term. It can mean, as in the case of Bottom's transformation from human being to animal, you know, Bottom thou art translated, a shift from one species to another. Or to be a little more accurate, a shift from human to animal that identifies, as Jan Kott once observed, and retains a shared kind of libidinal investment. Or it can, in a much more sophisticated deployment of the term, mean a shift from one discursive domain to another, and also a movement from one social position to another. In a brilliant reading of one of Shakespeare's most problematical plays, Timon of Athens, Hugh Grady has recently suggested that the poem that the poet intends to offer Timon for his approval at the beginning of the play effectively mediates a social context at the same time that it converts its empirical material by an act of aesthetic shaping, of translation into something else. At the same time, the subject of the poem is the agent of forms of social translation in that Timon's generosity to his inferiors is claimed to possess a transformative power in that it converts them into his social equals. Sir, I have upon a high and pleasant hill feigned fortune to be throned. The base of the mount is ranked with all the deserts, all kinds of nature that labour on the bosom of this sphere to propagate their states. Amongst them all, whose eyes are on this sovereign lady fixed, one do I personate of Lord Timon's frame, whom fortune with her ivory hand wafts to her, whose present grace to present slaves and servants translates his rivals. Now, Pistol's allegation against Falstaff exposes the contours of this dense but shifting process that traverses the full gamut between a meaning with which we're familiar to a much more complex, potentially incendiary use that is of a more local, historically and culturally specific provenance. Indeed, in order to grasp what Pistol's remark actually does here, involves us, and I use the phrase again, without apology, a form of cultural translation that has been in common practice in historical commentaries on the text of Shakespeare and his contemporaries for many generations. Now, in the exchange that precedes Pistol's heavily ironic observation, we can see how slippery a language English is, full of homophones, double entendres, and puns. But Pistol's gloss is of another kind altogether. On the surface of it, Falstaff's reading of Mistress Ford can transform what to everybody looking on is an ethical substance, her honesty, into English. In a fascinating account of translation as negotiation, Umberto Eco has recently drawn two important conclusions from a discussion of the way in which different languages covers what he calls the same semantic space. And he argues that such discussions suggest two possible ontological solutions. One, he says, there are universal ways of segmenting the continuum of human experience, even though our languages sometimes blur them. And secondly, in the continuum of our experience, there is a hard core of being. Not something tangible and solid, as if it were a kernel, that by biting into we might one day reveal, but rather some lines of resistance by virtue of which, for instance, we can speak in every language of crawling, hopping, or jumping human beings, but not, and in no case, of flying human beings. Now, he goes on a bit later to note that, quote, the utterance of the term is determined obviously by a given sensation, but the transformation of sensory stimuli into a precept is in some way determined by the semiotic relation between the linguistic expression and the content culturally correlated to it. And elsewhere in this rather provocative little volume, Eco is more formally scholastic in his suggestion that following Jacobson, translation is a species of the genus of interpretation. Here, of course, he shifts between sensory stimuli, linguistic expression, content, and precept in such a way that might have had very precise medieval scholastic authorities like Peter Abelard and Duns Scotus writhing in conniptions. On the surface of it, according to Ancient Pistol, Falstaff appears to have displaced a stable, abstract concept or a quality or precept honesty into a fraught linguistic arena of a sexual politics whose foundation is full of cultural difficulty. Precisely that incendiary combination of sensory stimulus, linguistic expression, content, and precept that Eco identified as being interconnected and in which translation itself is unavoidably entwined and that acts as a barrier to the concept of universality. No stranger to some of the most egregious cultural translations himself, Pistol appears to be accusing Falstaff of an identical practice by shifting meaning from one realm of signification to another as though they were two separate languages. Let's remember here as well that this is a script for performance and that Mistress Ford would not have been what she seemed on the Elizabethan stage, a detail that would only compound further the complexity of the exchange between Falstaff and Pistol. We should also bear in mind, of course, that in the earlier play, Henry IV, Part I, Falstaff is given a memorable soliloquy on honour, in which he asks, what is honour? A word? What's in that word honour? What is that honour? Air. And he concludes, honour is a mere scutcheon, and so ends my catechism. And we should also remember that in the later play, Othello, the words honour and honesty and what they connote become central to the actions of the tragedy. Iago presents himself to others as an honest man. Othello himself regards Iago as honest, and when Cassio leaves Desdemona, as Othello and Iago approach, Othello asks, is he not honest? And he goes on to assert that Iago is full of love and honesty. And later when Iago fabricates the narrative of Cassio's dream, and after he and Iago have seen Cassio hand Bianca Desdemona's handkerchief, Othello equates this object with his wife's honour. She is protectress of her honour too. May she give that? Iago's response locates the source of the problem in that honesty and honour are essences, although in his case, and as his rank of ensign suggests, his definition is much closer to that of the Falstaff of Henry IV, Part I. Her honour is an essence that's not seen. They oft have it that have it not. Now the point here, of course, is underlined not only by Iago's evident duplicity that we as audience are allowed to see, but of course that the characters with whom he interacts are not, but also by the fact that in the very literal sense and on the early Jacobean stage, Desdemona is not what she seems. She's a male actor dressed as a female, and she's not therefore in possession of the honour in question. She has it, and she has it not. Now, the term itself is a heavily loaded, historically specific, cultural signifier, and negatively construed, as it is in Othello, it will cost Desdemona her life. And it's into this fraught semantic domain that Falstaff's strategy of translation trespasses. And Pistol is under no illusion about what it might involve and about where it might lead. Now, Mistress Ford's body language, her outward show, even though we've no objective account of it, evidently denotes her honesty. To this extent, Pistol invites his English audience to subscribe to an ethical proposition, even though, of course, as a daughter of Eve, Mistress Ford's demeanour can never be fully transparent. And I mean, I could follow that right the way through Shakespeare up to The Winter's Tale, where it's very complicated. Indeed, like Desdemona's innocent gesture towards Cassio, her actions are open to misconstruction. Also, as in the case of Desdemona, Mistress Ford's will is constant, and even though as a married woman she's less naive than her later counterpart, she's still capable, as the actions of her husband reveal, of provoking extreme sexual jealousy. To this extent, the Falstaff Mistress Ford episode offers a comic prequel to a tragic alternative, we might say translation, that is pursued in Othello. What Falstaff effects, and in a more obviously libidinous manner than Iago, is a translation that, as Pistol astutely observes, implicates English itself in an assortment of dubious and unstable cultural practices that combine the categories of what Susan Bassant in a very different context describes as the interlingual, the interlingual, and the intersemiotic. Falstaff's own libidinous desire to make the object of his attention conform to his own preconceptions produces a misreading that undermines Mistress Ford's honesty by relocating it in a language, English, which has, of course, its own structures of feeling. Mistress Ford is simply the object of her desire, and her gestures comprise nothing more than a projection of Falstaff's own amorous agenda. This is the danger, I think, that besets all translation and interpretation, as they oscillate between the universal and the particular. The process of reference is not always what it seems, especially with regard to terms that carry a very particular cultural baggage, and honesty, especially within the context of agenda politics and as part of a discourse already saturated in particular value judgments, is just one such term. Now, Falstaff disregards the irreducibly connotative aspects of language in the process of translation, something that Pistol, in what we might read as an early critique of xenophobia, thinks is characteristic of English. In the context of Shakespeare's play, the egotistical Falstaff is content to ride roughshod over the local conventions of hospitality and friendship, as well as the foundational institution of marriage. Both, of course, are English constitutions within the context of the play, and taken together they supply the legal, religious, cultural, and social foundations of Elizabethan society. Falstaff's strategy is to discard any obstacle to his sexual desire for Mistress Ford, but Pistol distinguishes here between her honesty as a universal concept that transcends English and the meaning that Falstaff extracts from it in English that would make of it an obstacle to his carnal satisfaction. Of course, the merry wives, mistresses Ford and Page, who are not themselves averse from leading the fat knight on ultimately reclaim honesty for English, but not before Falstaff's translation has released some of its darker carnivalesque energies that the word and these institutions depend upon respecting of its connotations keep in check. In other words, they lay a particular claim to the category of the universal, but cast in their own image. Now, this comic example, I think, offers a serious gloss on the dangers of translation, and it asserts by implications the dangers that lurk at the heart of all language. Of course, Shakespeare wrote in English, and at a superficial level it resembles modern English. I mean, given the fact that English is now a global language, with all that that appellation entails, it's not surprising that the national poet should also be assumed to possess a universal appeal. But in one sense, of course, all good editions of Shakespearean texts in English are translations. They're modernized, they're glossed with meanings explained by reference to particular historical contexts, etc. But also, despite the advances in modern bibliographical techniques, it's still possible to find editions that depend upon essentialist modes of understanding. Let me give you a brief example, just to be mischievous. Ernst Honigmann's Arden III edition of Othello. The line, "This Ludvico is a proper man, a very handsome man," at Act 4, Scene 3, is allotted in the folio text of the play to Desdemona. It was amended in 1955 by M.R. Ridley, and it was allotted to Emilia, the servant woman, on the grounds that Desdemona isn't the kind of girl who might say such a thing. Now, the only authority for this emendation is an essentialist reading of Desdemona's character, derived from some autonomous individuality, rather than from her behaviour in the play or from the lines that are allotted to her. And in the controversial figure of Bianca, the play itself counsels against superficial and uncorroborated judgments of this kind. In fact, the play actually points up their dangers, since although Cassio, talking to Iago, is encouraged to think of Bianca as a prostitute, Bianca can defend her reputation vigorously against Emilia's claim that she's a strumpet, with the assertion that she's, quote, "no strumpet, but of life as honest as you, that thus abuse me. Whom do we believe? And what would be the basis on which we might ground our conclusions?" Now, such questions point to the complexity of the relationship between translation and interpretation that a play like Othello poses. Now, what's problematic in the episode from Merry Wives of Windsor is obviously magnified when we consider the process of transporting Shakespeare from one culture to another. I mean, whatever the virtues of experiencing Shakespeare in the original Klingon, Nicholas Meyer's General Chang is something of a literalist, or at least he appears not to have read his Saussure, much less his Jacobson, and certainly not his Walter Benjamin. I mean, there's little to choose between Hamlet's to be or not to be, and its seemingly literal Klingon equivalent, although we might observe that as a marginalised and demonised barbarian in the play, Chang's gallimaufry of quotations represents a vandalising of the Shakespeare canon, requiring Captain Kirk to strategically abandon his avowed favourite author and ideological weapon. But of course, if we consider Shakespearean texts from the perspective of their sources, then we quickly come to the conclusion that they are themselves very often palimpsests of quotation and citation, testimonies to the creative afterlife of already extant texts. Or, to put it in Walter Benjamin's terms, the history of the great works of art tell us about their antecedents, their realization in the age of the artist, their potentially eternal afterlife in succeeding generations. But more than this, Benjamin goes on to compare the act of translation with the process of gluing together of the fragments of a vessel that, he says, must match one another in the smallest details, although they need not be like one another. They must, however, he continues, lovingly and in detail incorporate the original's mode of signification, thus making both the original and the translation recognisable as fragments of a greater language. And in his essay, How Newness Enters the World, Homi Bhabha teases out a more radical strand in Benjamin's theory that allows him to exploit the metaphorical significance of the process of translation, focusing on what he identifies in Benjamin's essay as the element of resistance in the process of transformation. He goes on to suggest that this discloses a rupture in the continuity of history that makes visible the very writing of historical transformation. Now, Bhabha's here, he's not here concerned with the linguistic aspects of translation, but with the cultural implications of the concept of untranslatability that challenges what he calls the assimilationist's dream or the racist's nightmare, and moves towards, quote, an encounter with the ambivalent process of splitting and hybridity that marks the identification with culture's difference, unquote. Less interested in the post-colonial implications of Benjamin's thesis, Paul de Man notes that it argues, quote, the inability of trope to be adequate to meaning, even as it, he says, constantly uses the very tropes which seem to postulate the adequation between meaning and trope, unquote. But, and this proviso I think is important, he notes that Benjamin prevents them in a way, displaces them in such a way as to put the original in motion, to decanonize the original, giving it a movement which is a movement of disintegration, of fragmentation. I won't pursue that fragmentation issue, but it's a very important one. This serves to problemize considerably, I think, terms such as adaptation and appropriation as separate activities in relation to the afterlife of text generally, and especially when they're transferred from one genre to another. I mean, in relation to Shakespeare, if one takes the films of the Japanese director Kurosawa or the Russian director Kosintsev, they come immediately to mind in the way that which they transfer Shakespeare into very, very different settings from the ones that we're familiar with. But what do we make of films like William Reilly's Men of Respect, or Vishal Bhardwaj's films of Othello, Omkara, or Macbeth, or something like Po Shenlu's recent Bangzi opera adaptation of The Merchant of Venice, The Bond, not to mention various pornographic versions of Shakespeare, such as William Kaufman's Tromeo and Juliet, or the tantalizing Julius Eats Her. I've heard of that. I've never seen it. If Amy's got a copy, I'd love to see it. Talk to me afterwards. Let me give you a very brief example, and I won't have time to play the clip, although I've got it with me. This is William Reilly's Men of Respect. Now, what this does is to resituate Shakespeare's Macbeth into the genre of the mafia movie, and is itself intertextually related to a much earlier gangster version of the play, Joe Macbeth, from about 1955. I mean, this is Shakespeare's Lady Macbeth's speech as she welcomes Macbeth home after the defeat of Cawdor. "Your face, my thane, is as a book where men may read strange matters. To beguile the time, look like the time. Bear welcome in your eye, your hand, your tongue. Look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent under it. He that's coming must be provided for, and you shall put this night's great business into my dispatch, which shall, to all our nights and days to come, give solely sway and masterdom." That's the Shakespearean text. Now, Reilly reads this encounter, and he interprets it in a number of directions. Firstly, he translates it into another genre. And that business of shifting from one genre to another and what that might mean for translation, I think, is quite interesting. And the characters' names are changed to fit the new context. Macbeth is Michael Bartaglia. His wife is called Ruth. You'll see why. Duncan is Charlie D'Amico. And Banquo is Banky Cuomo, believe it or not. Which is the same, the names are, well, Banky Cuomo is straight out of the 1955 version. Now, in the scene in question, the scene from which I've just quoted, Macbeth, Michael Bartaglia, is lying naked on a bed while his wife, Ruth, is sitting on the bed beside him, clothed, right? Michael recounts the meeting with a fortune teller, and after pondering the possibilities, concludes, because he doesn't want to really do anything, "What will be, will be." Now, Catherine Borowitz's Lady Macbeth, a.k.a. Ruth, takes up the conversation. I'll try not to sort of adulterate an American accent. "Ruth, he's going to dick you around. Michael, you don't know that. Charlie's always been fair with us. We're part of the family. Charlie stood up for me, all right? I swore to Charlie. Ruth, I've stepped in shit on the street cleaner than Charlie D'Amico. Michael, this is Padrino D'Amico here, all right? We have respect. Ruth, Charlie respects the fat end of a bat, the sharp end of a stick. Charlie respects what he fears." And she then glances down at Michael's lower stomach. "And that ain't you," she says. It's wonderful. No. That is galaxies away from Shakespeare. The translation from verse to demotic prose produces a certain loss, we might say, in the subtlety of Shakespeare's text. But it identifies an aspect of the play that's occluded in the original. I mean, the protective self-interest of Duncan underneath the veneer of modesty. Ruth's coming, he's going to dick you around, is apposite in the light of the later discussion between the Macbeths, in which Lady Macbeth says, when you durst do it, then you were a man. For Lady Macbeth's size is everything. Now, what's at issue here, of course, is Michael's manhood. And with that one brief glance downwards, Ruth makes that clear. And then, of course, the line, I stepped in shit on the street cleaner than Charlie D'Amico, would in the text of Shakespeare's Macbeth, or if some critics are to be believed, Shakespeare and Middleton's Macbeth, be totally anachronistic. If only because in early Jacobean London, the streets were open sewers. You couldn't avoid doing it. I mean, her crude comment, of course, points up the difference between the play's historical context and its modern reimagining. Purists who treat the Shakespearean text as an original to be preserved as a museum piece through time will always be offended by the license that modern versions of Shakespeare such as this take. However, the shift from one domain of culture to another, or in even in this case, a shift from one culture to another, from British to American culture, while at the same time acknowledging the cultural capital that's associated with the play Macbeth, makes for a very complex series of negotiations. And also, the return of a text from the past to a popular culture, albeit a modern one, while at the same time shoehorning it into a particular filmic genre, simply compounds the difficulty. If we take Men of Respect as an example, the only way in which we can say that a text like Macbeth can have a universal appeal is that if we invoke a politics of globalization, replete with its implicit imperialism. Now, I want to conclude, if I may, with a deceptively difficult example that on the surface appears to be nothing more than a quotation embedded in a film that actually plays with fictional forms and some of the implications of mimetic art. The film, some of you may know, it flopped at the box office. It's John McTiernan's film, Last Action Hero. Yeah, some of you know it? Right. And it's cast in the nominal generic classification of kind of, you know, hard-boiled detective fiction. Stories built around the hero worship of a young boy, Danny Madigan, a fatherless teenager who's given a magic ticket that allows him to enter the world of his fictional hero, the maverick LA police detective Jack Slater, and he becomes his comic sidekick. The role of Jack Slater is played by Arnold Schwarzenegger. And the choice of the actor here is very important. The boy Danny has spent the early hours of the morning in the cinema, courtesy of an aging projectionist who's befriended him, and he's previewing the latest Jack Slater film that's yet to be released. And he arrives later at school, where the topic of the lesson is Shakespeare's Hamlet. The teacher is the actress Joan Plowright, the widow of Sir Laurence Olivier. And her task is to engage her unruly class in a play in which they appear to have very little interest. She tries to focus the class's attention by updating Shakespeare's play, and she tries to convince her pupils that far from being ponderous and diffident, Hamlet is the first action hero. And she does then what teachers often do, she shows the class a film clip. But as educators, we all know that the attention span of our students is limited. I mean, what Joan Plowright tries to do, and again, the casting is brilliant here, she tries to provide a context for the film clip, and her facial expression sort of measures the distance between a kind of commitment to high culture with which we would associate her and what she assumes, rather patronisingly, is the class's own commitment to TV and film culture. I mean, Hamlet's a play that's unremittingly violent, she claims, and Laurence Olivier, one of the world's most renowned classical theatre actors, is going to be known to the class, she thinks, from the Polaroid commercial and as Zeus in Clash of the Titans. And the clip she chooses, of course, flies directly in the face of her earlier claim, and the class titters, you remember, when they hear the play's Elizabethan English. And it's this point that Hamlet's hesitation over the prone figure of the praying king that Danny's imagination takes over. Schwarzenegger as Hamlet cuts through the play's sophistication. You know, hey, Claudius, you killed my father, big mistake. And Claudius is then summarily dispatched. Polonius steps out from behind an arras. And, of course, he's not fair. He machine guns him. The prince doesn't spend too long thinking about death. Yorick's skull is quickly deployed as a very effective missile. And the voiceover interpolates Hamlet's own diffidence, prompted by his accidental killing of Polonius. That's a punishment from heaven, you know, that I must be their scourge and minister, as something is rotten in the state of Denmark, and Hamlet is taken out the trash. I mean, Hamlet's profoundly ontological question, to be or not to be, is treated here as two alternatives, and is resolved with the toss of a hand grenade. The exploding castle is reduced to a cartoon explosion, a bit like Star Trek VI, I think, as the scene cuts to Danny at home watching TV while his mother's on the phone hearing about his late arrival at school. Question is, how do we classify this episode? Does it depend on the universal appeal of Hamlet, or is it a translation from one epoch to another, from one cultural register to another, indeed from one language to another? As a reading of the play, it resolves all of Hamlet's problems. A resourceful, iconoclastic detective with a range of technological instruments at his disposal can make light of the play's dilemmas. It also validates the teacher's claim that Hamlet is one of the first action heroes, insofar as it emphasizes action rather than ratiocination. In short, Schwarzenegger challenges two centuries of romantic readings of the play and of its central character. In some ways, it decanonizes the play, except, of course, that it depends upon a shared cultural history of its concerns. And for this translation and its tapestry of ironies to work, we need to recognize Joan Plowright and the Olivia film of the play. And we need to recognize the roles that Schwarzenegger usually plays in films, you know, Predator, Commando, the Terminator films, etc. Now, once we recognise and collate these elements, then what emerges, I suggest, is a very intelligent and an entertaining negotiation that requires us to shuttle between theatre and film as the sites of popular culture, between Elizabethan and modern demotic language, between high culture and the commercialised entertainment industry, and between dominant and marginalised forms of knowledge. It will not have escaped your notice that this is a New York classroom, that the teacher is English, she speaks a global language, and despite her evident condescension to her students, her authority is based on a presumption of the universality of English and Shakespeare. Now, the history of the Olivier film of Hamlet, itself a very specific reading, interpretation, translation of the play, tells another much more local and perhaps a little more sordid story. Thank you.